Oh, hi.
Not impressed. Yeah, I am impressed. Morning, everybody. It's 8 minutes after eight. And top of the morning to you. Welcome to Senate Finance. Everybody. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I was thinking of my mom this morning. Remember when she said, if you get your chores done, you can go out and play early. You know. So here we are. We get our chores done, we can get out earlier tonight. So that, and pigs fly. Okay. All right. Welcome to Finance. We have until 5 minutes to 10 today. Joined today by Senator Dyson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Bundy, Senator Stevens, and Co-Chair Green. Online with us this morning is KNI in Anchorage. Welcome to Teleconference Network. Purpose of today's meeting is to consider the following pieces, and we'll try to do it in this order and accommodate everybody's schedule as best we can. If you have a time constraint, I'd appreciate letting Sheila or myself know, and we'll move you around as best we can. First, we're going to do House Bill 418. Real Estate Commission Representative Rokeberg would like to get that so he can do other things. Then we're going to go to HJR 26 POMV bill. And then HB 417, Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. Then House Bill 15, Solicitations Consumer Protection, known as the no-call list. Then HB 559, the STEP program. Then House Bill 494, Electronic Payment for State Business. And House Bill 514, Child Support Enforcement. And then last, House Bill 545, State Lease and Contract Extensions. And that should be our agenda for today. We may get back, depending on what happens on the floor today, we may get back Senate Bill 395. When we tried to blend what we did yesterday conceptually with federal law, it became oil and water. And so they worked on it last night, couldn't get the language to fit. So they're working again this morning on it at 8 o'clock. And they being the railroad and the legislative attorney. So we may see that back this afternoon. So we'll stand in recess when we finish here and anticipate. Today's Thursday, so I think we're scheduled to come back at 1:30 today. And but we'll play that by ear as we move along. And I think that's all the update I have. Senator Green, anything come for the committee from the operating side?
No, I think we'll be meeting on the conference committee. Some point today. If I find out when that is, I'll announce it.
All right.
4:30.
This committee at 4:30 today. Anything else, Senator Bundy?
Was I not listening attentively? Did I not hear you reference HGR 26 when that would fall on the schedule?
I can't hear you, Senator Bundy.
HGR 26. When is that going to be?
Number two.
Thank you.
Oh, and I left out. Excuse me. Also, House Bill 422. Having to do with the budget reserve fund investment, that was asked to go last today because of some scheduling problems. So, Bob and let's see, you're here for PMV, of course. Anyway, House Bill 422 will go last at the because of some scheduling with the House Finance. So, okay, that's our agenda. Anything else, Senator Hoffman?
I have my cell phone turned off.
Thank you.
What'd you say?
I have my cell phone turned off.
Thank you.
Donuts.
More than donuts. So, okay. Anything else? All right. Let's take up House Bill 418, Real Estate Commission, and Ruth's here to present that this morning, Janet. House Bill 418 is a new bill sponsored by House Labor and Commerce, Representative Rokeberg. It extends the Real Estate Commission sunset date to June 30th of 08, and it clarifies some language concerning the Home Inspector Law. And we have with us Ruth Blackwell. Ruth is with us from the Alaska Association of Realtors to testify. We have one fiscal note, and we are dealing with version 2, I believe, Labor and Commerce Substitute. We have a number of amendments, which we'll get to here in just a second. And I think that sets us up for Janet. Good morning. Bill presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Janet Seitz, staff to Representative Rokeberg. As the Chairman said, House Bill 418 extends the life of the Real Estate Commission to 2008
It clarifies some procedures with regards to inactive licenses, real estate licenses, and notice procedures as recommended by the audit. And the third thing it does is change some language with regard to the home inspector legislation that we passed last year. And these language changes were engendered by the regulation writing procedure and some problems that the division and the home inspectors brought to our attention. That's the bill in a nutshell, and I can go into more depth on it, or I can just answer questions that come up, Mr. Chairman.
Questions of Janet? See none. Let's, Ms. Blackwell, would you like to testify now or after amendments, or let's take your testimony now. Morning, welcome to Finance.
Morning, thank you. My name is Ruth Blackwell. I've been a realtor for 22 years. I'm from Juneau. Didn't fly in for this. The Alaska Association of Realtors, first of all, want to say that they're solidly behind retaining the Real Estate Commission. The second thing we're asking is there's an amendment to currently the surety fund is at $10,000. We're asking for it to be rolled back to $10,000 in Senate Labor and Commerce. They raised it to $20,000. Our thinking of that is
could
that...
Could I interrupt you just for a second? Janet, will you come back up to the table? Yes. We have amendments 1, 2, and 3. Is one of those the one that she's speaking of?
Yes.
Which one?
Amendment 3.
Okay, so Ms. Blackwell, your testimony then will, when you get into this, is on amendment number 3. Okay.
Right.
All right, go ahead, just okay. So we know what we're looking at.
Okay. In 2003, surety claims jumped to 14 for the whole year. In that year, no claims were settled, or we don't see any hearings happening. Prior to that, there were 3 to 5 a year. I was on the Real Estate Commission twice, once real early on, and from 1995 to 2001. And the problem is that the Real Estate Commission only has one hearing officer that it shares. So obviously that hearing officer has to take license actions and things. What we would like to do is roll it back to 10 and spend the time between now and next session to see if we can fix the system so that the public is served. Right now, if it goes to 20, we might have 24 claims, but they're not gonna be heard. So there's not much point. What we would like to do is spend this time working on that process. Right now, the realtors have in place mediation, arbitration, and professional standards hearings, of which we've done 60 in the last year for our members. So we think that with some cooperation between the commission and the department and us, that we can come to some way of processing these quickly and that the public will be served. Any questions?
Thank you, Ruth. Questions of Ms. Blackwell, Association of Realtors? Okay. And from your testimony, I just made a note that you support amendment number 3 when we get to amendment number 3.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson?
Thank you. Does the Association of Realtors support the licensing of home inspectors?
Yes.
How did you go about determining that your membership supports that?
First of all, we poll our individual boards. On our legislative committee, we have one person, a minimum of one person from each board. And we poll our boards. Each board has a legislative committee in which their input goes into the state association's legislative committee, and we've supported the home inspector bill for 4 years and working it out. We spent a lot of time and effort in it.
And if I may continue, would you say that 99% of the real estate agents support it, or 60%, or what?
Well, I think it depends on what area you're in.
Uh-huh.
In Juneau, we do not have any home inspectors. Licensed or unlicensed, we only use licensed engineers. Just as a matter of, we just felt their license was better than ours. So in Juneau, we have not used, we would like to have some because they would be cheaper than our engineers. But at this point, we don't. In other areas of the state, they only use engineers, and I think that's, think Fairbanks. Other than that, I would say a minimum of 75% to 80% of our membership support having the home inspectors licensed. I can't say 99, I just...
Thank you. Other question, Alaska Association of Realtors? Okay, thank you, Ruth, for joining us. We've been joined on the teleconference network by Mr. Sandberg. He's representing also the Alaska Association of Realtors. Good afternoon, or good morning, Mr. Sandberg. Your testimony, please, on House Bill 418.
Again, representing the Alaska Association of Realtors. I've been a realtor for about 17 years, former national director of the National Association of Realtors. I'm also a member of the Professional Standards Committee, both on the national level as well as the state and local Anchorage area level. I basically am a mediator. I've been mediating disputes for the Anchorage Board and the Alaska Association now for about 14 years. Also work as a hearing officer and hearing chair for the arbitration and ethics hearing panels. The system we have has been in place for a long time. For our purposes, we can say for the past 14 years. What we have found is it's very effective. We resolve consumer disputes and that's consumer disputes between consumers as well as consumer disputes with our realtor members. With respect to that, it is a much cheaper and more efficient system. We have at least a 95% resolution record with regard to this where the problems are resolved. As near as we can figure, the surety fund resolves less than 10% of the issues that come before them. As Ms. Blackwell pointed out, last year 14 surety fund claims were filed, none were heard. We had 60 filed and 60 were heard and resolved. Usually it takes somewhere between 2 and 4 months for us to resolve disputes in our system, as opposed to, in some cases, a couple of years with regard to the system that's currently in place. We do urge that you roll back, by way of amendment number 3, that you roll back from 20,000 to 10,000 the surety fund issues, and then allow us, along with the Real Estate Commission, along with the appropriate parties, to review and find a way to more effectively deal with the issues that are before you.
Does that complete your testimony?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sandberg. Questions? Okay, thanks for joining us this morning. We've also been joined on the teleconference network by Fairbanks. Welcome to Fairbanks. We're having Fairbanks weather in Juneau this morning, I should tell you. Let's see. All right, other discussion before we consider amendments? Senator Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move amendment number 1.
Back for discussion, amendment number 1. Senator Green? Okay. Everybody have it?
Yes, it's been distributed. Mm-hmm. Many of us discussed the changes that the sponsor of this legislation brought forth last year in a bill that associated some work on home inspectors. And in the meantime, some of the things we tried to do and to correct and to work on last year, we never could get resolved. And in the meantime, I don't know, those of us who live in areas that have homeowners, home inspectors, who are not employees of the city or the borough and do the lion's share of home inspecting have found themselves in some awkward situations. The series of amendments I've offered today will help to correct that. That's not, and it takes it back in some places to the way it was originally. And I think there have been some unintended consequences. And in explaining amendment number 1, let me see if I can get this right, because I sometimes, there are two, the, one of the things that happened by the passage of HB 9 last year that we would like to correct is currently home inspectors are required to be individually licensed. Therefore, each registered homeowner is required to post a surety bond and to obtain a general liability insurance policy. This poses multiple bonding and insurance requirements in the following situations. When a business owner who is registered as a homeowner employs one or more persons who are also registered as home inspectors, and when a general or specialty contractor desires to also be a registered home inspector, and you have the multiple requirements that are imposed, and it's my understanding that they layer over and don't offer any additional protection. It's just a, it's the belts and suspenders things, but they're unnecessary. The corrective language in amendment number one makes provision for that. And if you fall into one of those discrete situations where you would qualify as an owner and as a home inspector, you do not have to have the two different coverages. You can, and I'm not sure exactly how the choice is made, but I think you do some work with the commissioner. Is there not an approval? Maybe Janet can help us with the finite points on that.
Mr. Chairman, the amendment that Senator Green is
offering. Janet, a little closer to that microphone, please. Thank you.
Move my chair up here.
That's okay.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Janet Seitz, staff to Representative Roachberg. Representative Roachberg does support the amendment that Senator Green has offered as amendment number one, and the situation that she's describing on the dual bonding is a concern. Because under the current law, if you were a specialty contractor and already had a bond, you had that bond, and then if you went to register as a home inspector, you'd have to have that bond. So you'd have two bonds instead of just the one bond. And the situation with the employee is the same, the way the home inspector legislation read, the registered home inspector has to carry the bond, even if he or she works for a company who has a company-wide bond. And Senator Green's amendment would take care of that and just require the one bond.
All right. Discussion on amendment number one. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. I got two or three questions for Senator Green. As I remember, is there a national organization for the home inspectors?
We also have online, I think, has Dave Owens phoned in yet? Yeah. There's someone online who can probably answer that question far better than I.
Yeah. What I did not agree with the legislation that got us into the business of having to license these inspectors. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that we could eliminate it entirely, or does this amendment eliminate the licensing and just ask them to be registered?
What this does.
I don't think it does.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, the amendment does not do that. However, we ask that they be registered in the original bill, in House Bill 9. So you register as a home inspector and then you get your registration.
Whenever
it's similar to a license, but it's not called a license. It's called a registration.
Registration.
And do all they have to do is meet the national standards of their organization that registers them?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, they have to prove that they have passed certain exams and have been in the business. When the transitional licensing, you have to meet a deadline for being in the business. And then once that period is over, then you have to show that you've passed a certain exam, depending on whether you want to be a new, existing, or a joint inspector.
And are those tests administered by the state or by their professional organization?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, they're administered by two or three different professional organizations. There's two or three testing agencies.
Senator Dyson, I think if you would refer to the bottom of page one.
Of the bill?
Of the bill. It has a little information. Existing homes is the examination offered by the American Society of Home Inspectors.
Right.
Or National Association of Home Inspectors.
Right.
Is that not correct, Janet? The testing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Green, that's correct.
And...
Oh, go ahead.
And in explanation of the bill, this legislation adds an additional layer in topic B, accompanied by documentation that the applicant has completed continuing education. And so it's not a license, and my amendment does not cover that. One of the other issues that became problematic after last year is handled in Amendment 2, which I think you're also going to like.
Thank you.
And like, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say, Mr. Owens has joined us. Senator, would you like him to testify now?
It would be wonderful, because he's a very good spokesman on this issue.
We've been joined on a teleconference network by Mr. Dave Owens from Owens Construction. Welcome, Dave. We have Amendment number 1 on the table. If you'd like to speak to that or to the bill, please provide your testimony.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. We can hear you just fine.
Okay. My name is David R. Owens. I'm the owner of Owens Inspection Services. We are a corporation that performs residential and commercial inspection work. I myself have been trying to get a license and have applied for a license, and we've run into stumbling blocks in getting our licensure taken care of. This dual bonding issue is one of them in Amendment number 1, where they told me my $10,000 company bond would not be sufficient, and I also have a liability insurance policy in place, and that I needed to get separate insurance, a liability insurance in my own name, and also a bond in my own name for the amount of $5,000, which I did and sent in. They sent me back and denied my license again because my testing was not been taken over the last 20 years at various times. Some of them are current and some of them go way back. So they, you know, one of the issues in this bill, the way it's written right now, is that you have to take your test within a year, or it's not valid to the way the legislation was previously written. So I was hoping to, you know, have some of this cleaned up here today so we can make this work for us.
Does that complete your testimony, Dave?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue that I would like to encourage is also the allowing the 1856-300C provision to be left in the Alaska Housing Statute. I think it's going to be covered in one of the other amendments, but that is also one of the issues that is very, very important to us. Again, taking care of this dual bonding, dual licensing, and getting the Department of Commerce to recognize our certifications rather than when we took our test. You know, the real issue is, do you have a current certification? Are you qualified in the area that you're inspecting? Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Questions of Mr. Owens? Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Mr. Owens, you said you were wanting to get licensed. Did you mean registered?
Yes, sir. Yes, I did.
So, all right, I'd be interested in, I'd be interested in discussion of what's the difference between registration, certifications, and license, but that's probably not subject for this conversation. Thank you.
Other questions, Mr. Jones? Okay, Dave, thanks, and you're more than welcome to stay in line as we consider the other amendments. Okay, back to amendment number 1. Further discussion? I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to adopting amendment number 1? Seeing none, amendment number 1 is adopted. Senator Green?
I would move amendment number 2, Mr. Chairman.
Back for discussion, Senator Green.
And for amendment number 1 and amendment number 2, I've been working with the sponsor of the bill. So, and as Mr. Owen said on the phone, one of the big concerns was a repeal that took place in HB 9 last year, and it was his reference he made to 1856-300C. And that line requires a home inspection for either the purchase or making of a housing loan by AHFC for residential housing constructed after June 30, 1992. And AHFC estimates it has 30% to 40% of the market share of mortgage lending for single-family residential dwellings. Subsection C had limited the liability of home inspectors performing the requirements of subsection B into gross negligence and intentional misconduct. When we took that language out last year, it exposes home inspectors to greater risk of legal actions against them, for which a prudent business owner would require professional liability or errors and omissions insurance. This type of insurance is not available in the Alaska marketplace. This has been investigated and confirmed by Linda Hall, director of the state's Division of Insurance. Therefore, we in our legislation required home inspectors to have a product in order to do business that they cannot obtain. And the sponsor has agreed to correction of that section by amendment number 2. And I see that our sponsor has just walked in.
Senator? Morning, Representative Rookberg.
Hello, Chairman.
We're just rolling right along. So don't slow us down. We're on amendment number 2. Any discussion with what Senator Green said?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay. Representative Rookberg, any discussion from your side, or should we just proceed?
Go right ahead, sir.
Okay. Let's see. Other discussion on amendment number 2? I'll withdraw my objection. Further objection to amendment number 2? Seeing none, amendment number 2 is adopted. Senator Green?
Mr. Chairman, as I told you, I had worked with the sponsor on amendment number 1 and number 2. This next amendment has come to me from two different people, and I just combined it into one amendment. The first half has come from Mr. Owens, and you may have heard him talk about the one-year limitation on qualifying for registration after having passed the examination, and that would change that time limit from 1 year to 3 years. And I don't know if the sponsor wants to comment on that or not. And then the second half of the amendment has come from various people, and it deletes the information added in labor and commerce and has to do with what Ms. Blackwell mentioned in the change to the surety fund.
Let's see if it's all right with the committee. Let's see, did you move that?
I did.
Okay.
I moved the amendment.
For clarification. Let's split the question and make page 2, line 7, 3A, and page 3, lines 12 to 22, line
3B.
So if that's all right with the committee, let's talk about 3A. Senator Green, everybody's located at Senator Green's, explained it from Representative Rookberg or Janet. Any comment?
No, I support the 1A.
Okay. Other discussion on 3A? I'll remove my objection. Further objection? Okay, 3A is adopted. 3B? Senator Green, would you like to speak to that?
I'll move 3B.
Yeah, for clarification.
And again, this is the language that was added in Labor and Commerce. And I've had several people call and said if we could get, they would like to have that changed from the 20,000 back to the 10,000. And the chairman of Labor and Commerce is here, so he may wish to speak to that, or Senator Bundy.
Okay. And we just were handed, by Senator Bundy, we were just handed something which I think he'll explain. So let's see, where to start? Let's ask Representative Rookberg first, for or against the amendment.
Might
any
I ask
thoughts?
A question, Mr. Chairman?
Oh, sure, pardon me. Senator Bundy?
Would the ultimate goal, result of this amendment being that all surety bond be removed? If you remove that entire section, which addressed the 10,000 that LNC had raised to 20,000, you remove all the surety.
Aren't you only new language?
It just says delete all material.
Let me see. Mr. Chairman, if I may try.
Jen?
This would remove section 6 of this bill, and it would revert it back to the current law, which is the 10,000 limit.
Thank you.
Good question. Representative Roachberg?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do support this amendment. We heard testimony earlier from Ms. Blackwell and the Association, Mr. Sandberg, that there's a concern, I think this committee well understands, the issues revolving around hearing officers and how that impacts all licensees and all areas of responsibility to come before administrative hearing officers. And we found it very, not real workable. And as the association has testified, that it's time now to look at restructuring the entire surety fund system. The way it works now is that even if there is a ward in a district or superior court, that the fund is available for reimbursement to any injured party if it fits the criteria of the surety fund, which is strictly in the areas of misrepresentation, fraud, or deceit. So we believe that raising the level from 10 to 20,000 is more appropriately dealt with by the judiciary system because of the high costs involved. And if the claim gets that high, then we believe it's most appropriate that be adjudicated in the court system rather than in the hearing officer system. Frankly, what it does is creates a new layer, so you could go from the hearing officer to appeal it to the district court, or excuse me, the superior court or the Supreme Court, but that's available anyway. So we think that raising this level may increase the incidence of claims when people trying to assert against them when in fact they should be in the district or superior court level. Also, for information, there is another bill moving through the system that raises the limit on small claims court. The first idea behind the surety fund was to simplify the process to the consumer, but frankly, the way the hearing officer system works in our state, it's more complicated and more expensive. So if there's basically a frivolous claim, the licensee ends up having to pay more legal fees just to defend himself before he can even get a dismissal. So we think this is almost would create more attractiveness to do that, and I think it's an unnecessary thing. When in fact, we've heard testimony that the whole system needs to be reformed because you heard the statistics about 60 resolved cases in a very short period of time, when in fact we can't even get the hearing officers to sit down and take up some of these issues. So we don't want to make it more attractive to go the wrong way, and we do need to reform that system.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Bundy?
Well, thank you. I respectfully disagree, of course, or wouldn't have suggested the amendment. A couple of things that I'd like to point out to the committee. One of the handout that I gave you, and I know we don't care much how they do things in the lower 48, but this is just a representative sampling of surety funds in other states, and you'll notice that Alaska is one of the three or four with the lowest level, and other states have 20,000 or more, it doesn't seem to destroy the real estate industry there. More importantly, I'd like to bring your attention to what's in your packet, the LB&A report, page 11. Now, Mr. Chairman, we have a wonderful facility, legislative budget and audit group in the legislature, and we frequently ask for audits of things like the real estate commission. And unfortunately, I don't think we pay enough attention to their recommendations. Recommendation number one from the last audit of the real estate commission is item one on page 11. And just point out a couple of things that this $10,000 limit was set in a 1974 statute. I don't think anybody would think you can do business in Alaska at the same price today as we did in 1974. This statute was amended in 98 to say no matter what the surety fund, the license fee for a real estate agent cannot be more than $125, or the fee involved here can't be more than $125. Currently, it's about $30 a license. And there's a maximum that the surety fund can consist of $500,000. It is pretty well stayed in that arena. It's never approached the minimum of $250,000. So the impact on the licensee, I think, is minimal. But the impact on the consumer, the person perhaps we ought to be equally concerned about, might be, as Senator Roquefort said. If you have a problem, you're more likely to address it, because most of the problems, according to Pat Davidson and from LB&A, involve more than $10,000 that have occurred in Alaska's recent past. So I'm suggesting that perhaps I pay some attention to what our auditor suggested and increase this fee, as they suggested, from $10,000 to $20,000, a fee that hasn't changed since 1974, and that the negative impact on the industry, or that the impact on the industry should be extremely small as far as the business end of it. It might be some advantage to the consumer, and indeed, if they are in process of some self-regulation revisions, this might encourage them along those lines. So I propose the amendment.
Okay, thanks, Senator Bundy. Other discussion on amendment number 3B. Representative Roquefort.
This really conveys this information, Mr. Chairman, is the use of the surety fund fee is for the consumer awards. However, there's a secondary use, it's educational purposes. The fund is in very good shape, and this year we're hopeful of having a major restructuring in one element of the licensing law. So the demands on the fund will be for substantial use of it for educational purposes. And this basically just goes back to licensing fees. Because of the way the system has worked, the fund is in a very healthy position, but that's just a matter of information, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused now as to what this amendment is going to do to the ultimate consumer. Is it going to raise his, is it going to cost the consumer more? Or make it more complicated for him to have a, appellate process?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. I'd say no to either one. Merely the amendment speaks to the ceiling or cap on the amount of the award that could come out of the surety fund. Also, for the committee's information, if, for example, there is a claim in the Superior Court level, the surety fund is available for any claim that would fit the criteria of misrepresentation or fraud or deceit. So the fund is always there to protect the consumer. It's particularly important if we have something I could call like a fly-by-night or not some licensee that doesn't have the net worth to be able to pay the judgment of any adjudication. So that's one primary reason the fund is there. But I think the history shows that the fund attracts people because it's like a pot of money. And frankly, we've had testimony in other committees on this issue relating to the use of the fund to try to leverage legal fees to take further court action. And many of the hearings that take place are dismissed. But the fund is there for the consumers to be protected.
Senator Bundy? If I might weigh in on that question, I again, respectfully disagree. I think this will, if this amendment passes, it potentially costs consumers money. I think Representative Roquefort's contention is if your potential loss is more than $10,000, you go to court. Well, in today's real estate market, the price of houses, it wouldn't take a very large percentage of the sale price to be more than $10,000, and I think we all know going to court is a very expensive operation. So my suggestion is that if your claim is for more than $10,000, current system requires you to go to Superior Court. If we reject this amendment, then we have the claim has to be more than $20,000 before you're forced to go into the court and all the various costs that that engenders.
Thanks, Senator Bundy. Senator Olson, on amendment number 3B.
To the sponsor, is that indeed true?
I'm sorry, Senator.
The comments that were made by Senator Bundy and the reservations he had about the amendment is you confirm that?
Well, I don't agree with Senator Bundy. However, I do recognize one thing that I will agree with him on is that the level has not been adjusted for some time.
Pat Davidson has come in the room and Janet, you can stay there. We'll just pull the chair up. Pat, do you want to join us? It's been our policy here to have LBNA at the table, and we've talked about audits, so perhaps you can help us with amendment number 3B. You're familiar with it. And it has to do, as Senator Bundy said, with page 11 on your audit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Morning.
For the record, my name is Pat Davidson with the Division of Legislative Audit. Our recommendation to increase the cap for an individual claim from $10,000 to $20,000 was looking at the history of the claims that had gone through the hearing process. That we noted over the four-year period that we audited, every one of the claims that had been approved by the hearing officer was indeed over $10,000. All but one was under $20,000. So the combination of the history of the actual claims as substantiated by the hearing officer, coupled with the fact that it hadn't been raised since 1974. We also looked at the health of the surety fund. And then there's another safeguard to prevent excessive costs being borne by the licensees of that cap that's set at $125, and currently it's only at $30. Those are the three main components that supported our recommendation. We had also made a recommendation that cumulatively, because you may have more than one individual transaction, from one, you'll have multiple transactions against one real estate agent. Besides an individual transaction cap, there's an overall cap. Currently, it's set at $50,000. It's set at $50,000. We recommended that one also be doubled to $100,000. However, we didn't see the history that we saw with the individual claims. And I believe that you're just looking at raising the individual transactions from the $10,000 ceiling to the $20,000 ceiling.
Representative Roper?
Chairman, I don't wish to take up any more of this time, this committee's time on this issue. So if I might suggest, if in the interest of the inflation factor that Representative Bundy properly points out, the testimony of Ms. Davidson, that perhaps we can modify this and say $15,000 and move on with life and your other more important bills.
Senator Green, would you accept an amendment to make line 20, $15,000 instead of
10? I would, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, 3B has been amended to insert $15,000 on line 20 and 21 on page 3. Thank you, Representative Roper. Is there a objection to 3B as amended? Seeing none, then 3B is as amended is adopted. And thank you, Representative Roper, for moving us ahead. Pat, is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we consider the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Everything else okay. Thanks for coming this morning. Representative Roper, anything from you or Janet?
I just would like to make one closing comment. Mr. Chairman, I apologize to the committee and the legislature for having to bring this whole inspector brought back again. But we found that the regulatory making process caused the necessity for some of these amendments to the bill, and which I'm not entirely happy with, quite frankly. So the amendments are a result of the regulations that were promulgated, and I didn't agree with the interpretation of many of them. But we had no choice, and I ask for the forgiveness and indulgence of both the House and the Senate.
Thank you. Any other discussion on House Bill 418?
Ms. Sherman.
Senator Green.
I do want to thank Representative Rhett Rotenberg for his assistance on this, because this has been an abiding issue in my neck of the woods, and so I appreciate his assistance.
Senator Green.
Ms. Chairman, I would move House Bill 418 out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection to passing House Bill 418? Seeing none, it passes from committee. Dave and Charles, thanks for joining us on the teleconference network this morning. Thanks, Representative Rotenberg and Janet. Pat, for your help also. Okay, let's see. That's number one. Let's go to number two, House Joint Resolution 26. Who's going to present that bill to us this morning? Rules Committee by request of LBNA. Bob, you can help us? Okay. House Joint Resolution 26 has to do with the PONV proposing an amendment to the Constitution that limits appropriations from the permanent fund to 5% of the average of the market value of the fund. We're working on version Z, Zulu, and we have fiscal note, one fiscal note. Let's see, Mr. Teal, I think, is here somewhere. David's going to share a concern with us this morning, so we'll do that. But before we do that, I don't have anybody on teleconference. Let's go ahead, Bob, if you would. Good morning, HJR 26, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Bartholomew, and I'm with the Permanent Fund Corporation. Mr. Chairman, House Joint Resolution 26 is the culmination of 4 to 6 years of work from the Board of Trustees to provide a simpler way to determine how much is available for appropriation from the permanent fund. The version that's before the committee is supported by the Board of Trustees. And I think the primary purpose has been explained a lot.
Bob, let me interrupt. Yes, ma'am. At ease. Hang on. We're losing senators because of committee hearings that they have bills. But everyone's expected to be back by about 9:15, 9:20. So we'll set HJR aside, and I apologize for that interruption. So let's see. Let's bring before us Representative Chenault. House Bill 417. Who's going to, Steve? Let's stand at ease and let's go down the hall and get Representative Chenault. I think he probably got off track here with our change in schedule. We'll stand at ease and wait for House Bill 417. Okay. Our members are coming back from their respective legislation. And apologize for folks for that interruption. It's that time of year. Let's bring before us House Bill 417. As soon as we can find House Bill 417, and then when we finish that, we'll come back with HJR 26. Okay, House Bill 417 is sponsored by Representative Chenault, who's joined us. It changes the responsibility of Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority to include a review of the economic viability of a gas line to Tidewater at a point in or near Cook Inlet. We're dealing with version A. We have a fiscal note. And with that, I think we have a couple of people. Mr. Hines has joined us from ANGUF to answer questions, and Mr. Pop from Soldotna Kenai Peninsula Borough has joined us for testimony. And with that, Representative Chenault, if you'd present your bill, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mike Chenault. I'm the representative to District 34 on the Kenai Peninsula. You've pretty much summed up what the bill does and what my sponsor statement really has to say. This allows ANGUF to look at a route to Tidewater in Cookin, but also as part of the project. In 2002, in the general election, the voters of Alaska voted to give the authority to look at a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay south to Tidewater at on Prince William Sound with the spur to the Cook Inlet gas distribution system. And we feel that it is of importance to Alaskans, to the 70% of Alaskans that live along another proposed route to Cook Inlet, that we at least look at that option and see if that may also be a viable option, if not a better option than the route that the voters approved. This doesn't take anything away from the current issues that the ANDA board are looking at, and I think we just enhances it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer any questions anybody has.
Thank you, Representative Chenault. Questions of the bill's prime sponsor before we go to testimony? Seeing none, we've been joined in the room by Steve Porter from Revenue. Steve's here to answer questions. If you have any, we'll call on Steve. Let's go to the teleconference network. And Mr. Hines, I would assume that you're in support of House Bill 417?
Mr. Chairman, this is Harold Hines. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. I certainly am supportive of the bill. It adds to the responsibilities of ANGDA. Our focus on getting gas to Cook Inlet is already part of our mission, and we don't see this in any negative way in that regard. Probably the only note I should make to you is that in regards to our ability to study this in a very careful and economic way, we are working very much at a feasibility level, and because of that, there's really not a lot of difference in work looking at this, a direct route as opposed to a route through Glen Allen, and we certainly intend to include that as part of our work regardless of what goes forward here.
Thank you, Harold. Questions, Mr. Hines? Thank you, sir, for joining us today. Mr. Popp, good morning. Welcome to Finance. Your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair. Bill Popp, oil and gas liaison for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Obviously, the Kenai Peninsula Borough supports passage of this legislation. We believe that it is taking to a new level the responsibility of ANGDA as an entity of the state to perform due diligence to examine the idea of the main route going to Tidewater in Cook Inlet, in addition to the issues of the spur line that are already covered under the Proposition 3 language that was passed. We believe that a clear and detailed comparison of route economics are very important towards making this project successful. This project faces a number of challenges economically, and we believe that the state of Alaska, through ANGDA, should not have its hands tied in regards to looking at finding the most viable route to help make this project a reality if the economics support it. With that, I'll end my testimony, sir, and take any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. Questions, Mr. Popp? Seeing none, thanks for joining us this morning. Anybody else in the teleconference network? Okay. Back to the table. Will of the committee? Senator Bundy?
Just a question I wanted to clarify with the bill sponsor. I think what I heard stated was ANGDA is looking in this general direction anyway. It falls within the parameter of what they would choose to do, and so it would appear to me that any additional funding because of the if we pass this initiative would not be necessary.
Steve, can you help us with that?
Steve Porter, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Through the chair, Senator Bundy, you are correct.
Thank you.
Other discussion on House Bill 417. Senator Green?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 417 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection to passing House Bill 417 from committee? Seeing none, it passes from committee. Thank you, Representative
Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines, Mr. Popp, for your help this morning, and Steve, for yours also. Okay, we'll stand at ease. You're going down. Please come back to order. Thanks for your patience as everybody went off. You know, flurry to rewrite their own legislation.
Fancy that.
Yes, how appropriate for the 114th day of the session.
You don't look after it, nobody else will.
Mr. Chairman, are we still going on the floor at 10 o'clock?
We're going to go on the floor as soon as we deal with HJR 26. And Senator Terrio, no, not yet,
Trying to be helpful.
And Senator Terrio knows that we're going to deal, oh, there he is right there. We're going to deal with it, and when we finish with HJR 26, we'll recess and come back at 1:30 or right after the floor session to take up our agenda as I listed out today. So with that, let's start all over again and bring before us HJR 26, which is known as the POMV bill, and it proposes an amendment to the Constitution that limits appropriation from the permanent fund to 5% of the average of the market value of the fund. We're dealing with version Z as in zebra. And to present the bill this morning is Bob Bartholomew from the Permanent Fund Corporation. Committee is all back together. So, Bob, if you would, HJR 26, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll probably try to make 3 points on why the Board of Trustees has been working on and bringing this proposal forward and working on it for the past 4 to 6 years. And that is looking forward to how to prepare the permanent fund for the future, both from an investment management perspective and from the perspective of how to make a stable, predictable amount of money available to the legislature if they desire to appropriate it. And the constitutional amendment has passed the House of Representatives and is in a version that still represents what had been introduced by the Board of Trustees. And what the constitutional amendment does is put a spending limit of 5% of the value of the permanent fund on an annual basis. And just to put it in perspective, if that was in place for the next fiscal year, there'd be approximately $1.3 billion available. The significant change is under the current approach that's being used, if the legislature had the need or the for additional resources, in excess of $4 billion could be appropriated, and the permanent fund is invested in long-term assets. So the goal is to try to make a stable, predictable payout so that you can be invested for the long term. The other concern they had is if fiscal pressures come in the future, one of the ways to make one of the state's largest assets continue to be as productive as possible is to protect it against inflation. And that's currently an annual appropriation that the legislature does and has done for the last 22 years. And that would be something that happens inherent in the system through the spending limit. So their objective is to limit spending, protect the fund against inflation, and let the legislature and the public know on a predictable basis what's available. And Mr. Chairman, that's what HJR 26 accomplishes.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Questions of Mr. Bartholomew, Senator Bundy, and then Senator Hoffman.
Well, just a rhetorical to clearly put on the record and for the public, passing this, while it might be a precursor to some future activity that would use some of the earnings for supporting state services, just passing this does nothing to determine how the funds are spent.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct. There's two major public policy issues regarding the permanent fund that I think are being discussed in the legislature this year. The first one is the proposal from the Board of Trustees on what's the best way to determine what's available and protect the permanent fund for the future. And that's what the constitutional amendment does. It does not change how you would use it, just the amount. Then there is other legislation, HB 298, that has been discussed that would make a policy decision on how do you want to spend what's available from the permanent fund. And those are two separate questions.
Mr. Chairman, just to put a little finer point on it, passing this would allow future legislators to either take all the earnings of the, as calculated on this 5% and put them into dividends, or take all the earnings and put them into funding state services, or some combination thereof.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct. This bill would make, or this constitutional amendment would limit the annual amount available, subject to the legislature.
Thank you.
Stand by. Thanks, Senator Bundy. Senator Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was flipping through the Anchorage paper, since we're dealing with POMB, and see this big, I think it's 3/4-page ad on a look at POMB, and it says on the bottom, and I guess I was wondering, what was the intent of the board when they says that this is brought to you by the Alaska Permanent Fund Board of Trustees, and what was their intent in passing it, and who actually paid for this advertisement?
Through the chair, Senator Huffman, the ad was paid for by the Permanent Fund Corporation out of their operating budget. The discussion that led to, you know, what do we need to do to continue to educate the public, and I think the feedback that we've been continuing to get from polls other people have taken, from information that the Permanent Fund has gathered, is that there's still a high level of confusion in the public as to what is the proposal. And the discussion was, there's a lot of awareness and interest right now on what's going on with the Permanent Fund, and it's an opportunity to provide the education in as neutral a fashion as we could do. So the intent was to try to continue to, in a simple way, explain the difference between how the guidelines for the Permanent Fund work now and how they would work under a percentage of market value or endowment approach.
Senator Huffman?
Well, it seems as though the issue of the Permanent Fund Board and their spending to inform the public was discussed at this table, and there was a request, I think, of in excess of $1 million to do that, and I think this board didn't think that was wise at the time, and that was and had eliminated that from the budget. So why are they persisting to do this? If, you know, if that, I think, was an issue that we had discussed, you know, and that request was denied.
Through the chair, Senator Huffman, the request for both the authority to do advocacy and for the funding to do the education and outreach on percentage of market value was because of the rule changes that take place once this was a passed by the legislature. If passed by the legislature, there would be restrictions on whether you wanted to allow the Permanent Fund Corporation to influence the outcome of an election. And the direction that we've received in the initial discussions was that authority and money was not initially granted. So we did receive that message that once this was a ballot initiative, without further direction from the legislature, we could not go out and advocate for a constitutional amendment. And so in my discussions with the board, I guess I did not link with them the denial for advocating once it was a constitutional amendment versus what we'd been doing, you know, for the past 18 to 24 months of just trying to stay in the public awareness about what the percentage of market value would do.
So one final question, I guess, that I have is that, so it was not discussed, and it was not the intent of the board to take this ad out to try to get the public to put pressure on the Alaska legislature to take action on POMB?
That's correct, through the chair, Senator Huffman. It was not the intent to, and I discussed that when I talked with the board members, that is an issue that we had to balance, that it's not appropriate for us to indirectly lobby the legislature. We have authority to come here, meet directly with individual legislators. We do not have the authority to call the public and have them influence ask the legislature to act. And we did discuss that as the, and the response was that as long as we have an ad that a reasonable person can look at as education, is, and take this time when there's a lot of awareness, that was the decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bob, I just got to tell you that you're a good soldier, and I'm glad you work for the people of Alaska. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I guess the comment that I have to the questions that were asked by the previous senator seemed to be somewhat confusing at best, if not questionable, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other discussion? Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. This time, the last time we were here, I keyed off of a phrase in this document. On the line 34 from the bottom, it said, funded is invested for 5% real rate of return after inflation. And I somewhat awkwardly asked the question if the 5% that's on top of page 2 here, line 2, if indeed that was going to be after inflation, and you and I had some subsequent conversations, and as I remember, you kind of reminded me that this whole thing is a smoothing operation, you know, and it's on a 5-year average. And so my question is, have you thought about or considered any language that we might amend in here that would make it clear that the 5% that we're making available for appropriation is protected against the year that we might have high inflation, and actually in a given year might be appropriating part of the real value of the corpus? And I agree with what I understood you to say, that anything we did along that line would have to be carefully worded so that it was over a broad period, because it would vary from year to year. But my question is there a way that we could make it clear here that in any given year we would not be dipping into the principal? And I'm thinking about this not only for the value of the principal, but the sensitivities of the people that we're asking to vote for this. I think they need some assurance that the principal is intact. Can you help us?
Yes. To the chair, Senator Dyson, this the issue of would a percentage of market value allow you to spend into the corpus or principal of the permanent fund has had a lot of discussion, and there's two ways that were discussed on how would you provide protection so that you don't erode the fund. And how that currently is achieved is the word principal, and the concept of principal is included in the Constitution, and that is a number that is the sum of all the oil contributions, all the inflation-proofing appropriations the legislature has done, and special appropriations. So it is a number that only goes up, and that's currently $23.5 billion. And the legislature would not be allowed to appropriate any money that would reduce the permanent fund below that level. The issue that the Board of Trustees raised is that there has been periods 2 years ago where short-term extreme downturns in the stock market take the whole value of the permanent fund down towards principal. And we felt that when you have a $24, $25, $26 billion fund, it wouldn't be prudent for the economy if there was no distribution from the permanent fund. And they proposed what an endowment method of protection of not just the principal of the fund, but the entire fund. And so if I was to try to answer directly, how do we assure the public that we are not going to spend into the corpus or the core of the permanent fund? The House of Representatives adopted a statutory limitation. And how that works is the Constitution would allow 5% of the value to be spent in any 1 year.
Market value.
5% of the total market value.
Not the principal, market value.
That's correct. And it is the entire fund, which is the principal and excess earnings. And that's currently $27.5 billion. When there are years, and that 5% comes from, we expect the total return of the permanent fund to be roughly 8%, inflation to be 3%, so we only spend the real earnings after inflation over the time. And Senator Dyson's question is, how do we assure the public that we're only going to spend that 5% real, and if you don't earn it, how do we know that? And in House Bill 298, there's a provision that says, and I've got a picture of it I can hand out to the committee, but it basically says, we're going to look at a 10-year period, and every 10-year period, we're going to look, and if the permanent fund has not earned above the red line, and the red line is the 5% above inflation income to the permanent fund, if we, over a 10-year period, do not earn 5%, say it's 4.75%, the spending limit would no longer be 5%, it would drop. It would follow down to the real rate of return. So we would recommend that you don't look at it year to year. There are definitely years the permanent fund has not made money. In the bear market, we lost money. But there has never been a 10-year period where we have not exceeded the 5%. And if we look today, from the day the permanent fund started through where we're at today, for over that 25-year period, we've earned 6% over inflation. So the permanent fund has grown, and the legislature has not spent anywhere near the available funds. So right now, the protection Senator Dyson is speaking to is a statutory limitation. If you wanted a higher level of protection, you would have to move that protection from statute into the Constitution.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, so if we had a year that I hope never returns, where we had real high inflation, we would not be able to, with double-digit inflation or near that, we would not really be able to inflate it, inflation-proof that year, but we would still be able to appropriate up to 5% of the market value. So we could have a net loss in the market value of 3%, 4%, 5% that year because we didn't, the performance didn't exceed the inflation rate.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that's correct. But what makes that allowable and prudent is that this current fiscal year we're in, we're probably going to exceed the rate of inflation by 10%. So the permanent fund's going to, in addition to covering the effects of inflation, it's going to grow by 10% of the market value. And you're going to be, if this was in place, you'd be constitutionally limited to a 5% spending limit. So you would carry forward additional money, 5%. And over time, we believe the good years will outweigh the bad years, and that's been the history. We can't predict the future, but that's why we've adopted the spending limit is what protects the permanent fund, we believe more than anything else right now, is limiting the spending in the good years. When you make well over 5% and keep that in the fund through a spending limit, that's what allows you to have a sustainable, stable payout every year, and you're not at the whims of the financial markets, but you're still protecting the permanent fund.
Thank you. Before we go to Senator Stevens and Senator Bundy, Mr. Maloney, you're on the off-net for House Bill 514. Are you still there?
Yes, I am, Senator.
So we're going to finish our meeting here this morning and then recess to this afternoon. And I wonder if you could leave someone a number. And you're just there to answer questions, I understand. So I suspect if you could leave someone a number, they could call you. We probably won't be at a House Bill 514 until I'll just guess 3:30 plus or minus an hour.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir, for holding on there with us. Okay, back to Senator Stevens and Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that we all understand the comment that Mr. Dyson was trying to get to. And if I might
bring the attention to the members and everybody that Section 3, or the transition period, on the effective date of the amendment, it actually sweeps the earnings reserve balance into the principal on that day. And so there is no such thing as an earnings reserve. It all becomes principal at that point. And I think the public needs to understand that, and that 298, which sets out the distribution that has been printed in the paper and the distribution that has been talked about, is at the full discretion of future legislators to change that at any time there's a simple majority of the vote. And so that the concept of the distribution of the earnings is at the full discretion of future legislators, just as it is now. And that the only difference is that it sweeps the earnings reserve balance into the principal.
Technically,
that's it, thank you.
And while we're on that, Bob, is there, the bill is drafted, does it allow for an 05 draw if it was passed? Is there a concern with timing?
Mr. Chairman, as drafted, there would not be an appropriation allowed under the percentage of market value guidelines until July 1st, 2005, which is the beginning of FY06. So the dividend that would be paid this coming October, which is FY05, has already been appropriated for in the FY04 operating budget. So there, unless there was other needs for appropriations, as written, there would be no additional funds spent from the permanent fund in fiscal year 05 other than the dividend that will be paid in October 2004. Then there would be a limit to no appropriations until you got to July 1st, 2005, and then the legislature would have 5% available for appropriation.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Going back to the line of questioning that Senator Dyson had, I hear not infrequently from, I think, people who are suspicious and perhaps misinformed that if we were to pass this, it simply begins a process of spending the entire corpus or of the permanent fund, and the notion that if this passed, the permanent fund would go away. You've given us a 10-year look back here, and I think it's safe to say that as far as stock market performance, the 2003-2001 recent past was the worst stock market we've seen since probably the Great Depression. And even with that worst case scenario, the fund still made more than 5%. So had this been in effect 10 years ago, even with that terrible stock market, we would not have used any of the corpus. We still would have been able to, to appropriate anything. Any appropriation would still have been within the 5% category. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct. For the history of the permanent fund, if we would have been following the 5% annual spending limitation, we never would have spent more than what the permanent fund had earned above the rate of inflation, which is the proposal. And just to reiterate, each of the points on this chart that I've handed out represents a 10-year period. So you're seeing a 10-year period. So the worst, the bear market, which happened in 2001, 2002, you can see the average for the 10 years was starting to drop. But we had the good years 5 years before that, 4 years before that. So that's the importance of looking at it over time, not year to year. But what House Bill 298 proposes is if this blue line, which is the average earnings of the permanent fund, went below the constitutional spending limit, it would give guidance to the direction, to the legislature, to lower that spending limit down to the real earnings. And that was done because of concerns of that in case you don't earn 5%, that is a valid question, and they decided that it was important to put that protection in there so that if it doesn't happen, then the expectation would be the spending limit would be reduced.
Senator Bundy, is that...
Yeah, and one more thing, if I might, Mr. Chairman. Currently, the legislature appropriates from the earnings of the permanent fund inflation proofing, and it's somewhere between $300 and $500 million each year. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, that is correct. There's an annual appropriation that the legislature has made that takes money out of an earnings account and transfers it into the protected principal. And under this proposal, the earnings are immediately protected, subject to a spending limit. They're not subject to a future appropriation.
Mr. Chair, if I might, then one way to describe it is if we pass this constitutional amendment, we would stop spending up to $500 million of permanent fund earnings each year, or stop appropriating it at least.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct. You wouldn't need an appropriation, but when the board was evaluating why is this an important policy, part of the concern they had was when fiscal pressures, if fiscal pressures come to bear and there's a need for additional funds, the annual appropriation that they've made up to $500 million, $600 million to protect the permanent fund against inflation would be tough if there were other needs, education, transportation, and that they would have to balance, do I inflation proof or do I take care of needy or, you know, required state services? This takes that issue off the table and says, we're going to find a way to operate the permanent fund to first take care of inflation so that it's the fund will be around in the future producing the maximum yield it can. And so that inflation proofing is taken care of by a spending limit of retaining earnings in the fund and only allowing the expenditures of earnings after you have taken care of that.
Senator Bundy. And Mr. Chairman, I certainly understand all that. A point I'm trying to get to is many people say, don't spend the permanent fund, and a lot of the public doesn't understand we already appropriate over $500 million for inflation proofing, for the hold harmless, for just running the dividend program itself. And if you take that sum of money and then takes what some people propose, that you'd have a 5% payout and half of that would go to dividends and half would go to state spending, that would not change significantly the amount of money we're spending out of the earnings for state spending right now, or for state issues right now, if you include inflation proofing as an expenditure, which I do.
Okay, let's see. Senator Olson, did your hand go up there?
No, actually.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Yes, I guess my question will follow Senator Bundy's comments and Senator Stevens' comments. Obviously, the legislature can spend those dollars with a simple majority today, but we haven't, and we can. And I feel that the people would perceive that as tapping into the fund and potentially threatening the fund. Why else would the legislature, in balancing their budget, take a more difficult road? That more difficult road is before us today, and that is going to the CBR, requiring a three-quarters vote to balance the budget when they have a clearly a simpler road to travel, and that is to spend money from the permanent fund earnings reserve account with a simple 11 and 21. The reason is the public's perception that fund is protected, that's the nesting. The problem, I guess, with POMV, without us deciding first on how the dollars get allocated, the public, the politicians down here, all of us, could go back and after POMV is voted upon, they can say they voted on it and they're giving us permission to spend the 5% now. So the gap or the that difficult decision on whether or not we should balance a budget using the CBR vote, which is a three-quarter vote and clearly more difficult, even higher than the two-thirds requirement may not be there, because they may say the voters have sanctioned POMV and allowed us to spend 5%, so we can start using that fund. But what protections are there in this vote for the dividend? None. And that, I guess, is the problem that I have. You know, I think the voters of Alaska, given the option, and I think the Conference on Alaskans have also recognized it. They were they spent days up in Fairbanks from all walks of life, and that may be questionable to some, but all walks of life from Alaska have said they went one step above and beyond what they were asked to do, and that one step was that the permanent fund should be protected and it should be in the Constitution. So somewhere, you know, when we're discussing this, I think, what will we do to assure that the permanent fund is protected? How do we make the permanent fund dividend a really permanent fund dividend and not up to statute? Because today, if this passes, it's not going to be a permanent fund dividend. It's going to be as prescribed by HB 298 or amended thereafter by any legislature that comes after us. And people say, well, we can't tie the hands of Alaskans when we're talking about how the 5% should be. Well, we surely tied Alaskans' hands when we set up the permanent fund. And I say to you that that probably is one of the best things we did. So I guess I have some serious concerns on voting on this approach and giving a two-thirds vote on a constitutional amendment that says that it's purely a management tool but can be interpreted differently without us either looking at House Bill 298 or addressing how the fund and asking the people how the fund should be spent. It is clearly a management tool, but I for one need to know that, and I feel Alaskans will say that the dividend should be protected, and given the opportunity, will vote to, they will want to vote on how the dollars, how that 5% is going to be split. And people say that that again is going to be tying our hands. But why should we, why can't we ask the people? It's the people's money, and they should have a voice in how it should be spent. They perceive it as theirs, and I perceive it as theirs.
Thanks, Senator Huckman. Other discussion? Senator Bundy.
Well, probably I'm saying this for floor debate, but I think that same moral authority that keeps us currently paying a dividend, even though we don't have to, that money's available to appropriation, would keep a dividend coming. But the people do have a way, a voice on how their money's spent. At least the people from Bit and Bethel, they have you, and the people from South Anchorage have me.
Okay, other discussion. Bob, clarify for us, if you would, when you say 5% of the value of the fund, that's the 5% of the value of the fund at a point in time, certain point in time over the last 5 years?
Mr. Chairman, certain of the rules on how it would be applied are in the are in statutes, and so it would be as of June 30th, so at the end of each fiscal year, which is when we get our audited financial statements, that's the date that we would determine the value of the permanent fund. And to smooth out, in case there's large ups and downs in the financial markets, it's prudent to take an average of the previous 5 years. So this proposal would say, look at a five-year average of the market value of the fund as determined on June 30th under generally accepted accounting principles. And then it would be that value. That would be a very simple formula. You'd multiply it by 5%, and that would be the available amount.
So it would be 5 June 30th divided by 5, okay? Okay, other discussion? Nobody on teleconference. Anybody else in the room on HJR 26? Any amendments? Rule of the committee? Senator Bundy?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move HDR 26 from finance with individual recommendations.
Objection to passing HDR 26 from committee. Excuse me, Senator Huffman?
Chairman, I would just like to state that by my not objecting does not mean that I support the proposal.
Senator Huffman? Is there objection to passing HDR 26? Seeing none, HDR 26 passes from committee. Thank you, everybody, for their patience to get that done this morning. Let's come back to the schedule. We'll convene as soon as per floor as we can. And we'll start with House Bill 15, go to House Bill 494, 514, 545, 559, and 422. And we'll try to get everybody in. Is there anything else to come before the committee before we stand in recess? Senator Bundy?
Mr. Chairman, I, at 1:30 or immediately after floor session, we'll have a brief Labor and Commerce committee meeting. But should be able to join you in your deliberations later.
Well, we'll try to accommodate everybody's schedule. I think these bills should go fairly quickly, although I always hesitate to say that. So, anything else? All right, we stand in recess to the call of the chair. It's back to shortly after the floor session.
The time is 5:10 p.m. And Senate Finance is adjourned for the day and will readjourn tomorrow morning at 8 a.m.